Welcome to 88 Names Podcast with your hosts Blake Collier and Matt Ruff. On today's episode, we will be talking to Dr. Todd Chang, pediatric emergency medicine physician at the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, who does research into virtual reality and medical education simulation.
Drooted is a proud sponsor of the 88 Names Podcast. Drooted, immersive experiences and interactive activations helping brands connect globally. Find case studies and more at drooted.com.
We are talking to Dr. Todd Chang, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Medical Education, Educational Scholar at the Keck School of Medicine at University of Southern California. He also works at the CHLA Los Medrinos Simulation Center, and he is a, as he would say, regular old doctor, MDA. And so we are super excited to have him on. He's going to talk to us today about where medicine and operations and VR kind of intersect. And so thank you for coming on and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. This is pretty exciting.
Wonderful. So for those listeners who are not familiar with you and what you do, do you mind telling us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how your work intersects specifically with VR technology?
Sure. It's a bit of a long history and perhaps different than most people who work in VR, but my formal training is in medicine. So I practice as a physician at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. My clinical training has been in pediatric emergency medicine, exactly as it sounds like. I finished all that training in 2010. And during the process of medical training and then my years as faculty, I became pretty interested in medical education and a field really called simulation. So if you are CPR certified or lifeguard certified, you've probably done these where you say to a little mannequin on the ground, Annie, are you okay? And you practice rescue breaths and CPR. So that's a form of simulation. And nowadays, you can actually add a lot of technology to the mannequins, the environment, and then digital technologies like VR. So I got very interested in the world of simulation. So I do research as well as education in how healthcare providers of various different disciplines learn critical healthcare skills, whether it's decision-making or procedural skills, at the height of a very stressful environment, like an emergency department or a critical care unit. And that part is actually quite fascinating to me. It's one of the parts of medicine, healthcare, whether you're nursing or medicine or whatnot, that's really difficult to teach because, number one, the events are pretty rare. And number two, you know, if your loved one or yourself is actually having a medical emergency, that's not really the time to have, you know, hey, students, come on over, right? That's just not appropriate. So, and you want the best and the most senior person preferably. So the actual way of training is a little bit different in those situations. So that's where healthcare simulation came about. The military does quite a bunch. The airline industry does simulation and healthcare does it. What I've heard, Peter Weinstock in Boston Children's is credited for this, is that healthcare is one of the fewest, actually the least last industry in which regular rehearsed practice is not expected nor encouraged. Right? Broadway does it. The military does it. Airline industries do it. The military, right? But you never think of your doctor saying, hey, I got to take the day off so I can go rehearse for your for seeing you tomorrow as a patient. All right. And what we're trying to do with simulation and through VR is to change that culture. So once we got into mannequin-based simulation, then I got into serious games simulation, so digital simulations on a screen, and then finally to more immersive virtual reality. Back in 2016 is when I first started with my colleague Josh Sherman.
On a more practical level, do you mind giving us some insight into the process of developing some of these VR simulation programs? I'm guessing you've been a part of the actual creation of them. And So I wanted to see what that process of putting all the pieces, I would assume many pieces together into an accurate simulation of medical operation looks like. Like, what's the process?
Sure. I think that's a really good question. And of course, you'll get that trademark. There is no one process.
Yes, of course.
There's many different versions. But I could tell you a little bit about how we approached it. Back in 2016, we were fortunate enough to have some really great companies work with us, plus through the Oculus VR for Good campaign back in the day. And we got partnered as both clinical experts, so subject matter experts, and both Josh Sherman and I had experience in designing simulation scenarios. In other words, we knew how to craft a mannequin scenario to simulate something like a cardiac arrest or perhaps a seizure or something that required immediate attention. And so we were able to use those skills and apply it to the digital realm and had a fairly talented, very talented, that sounded bad, a very talented group of programmers, developers who were really familiar with the VR world already, as well as the cinematic world. I work in Los Angeles, so that's a nice skill to have here as well. Yeah. We the physicians, basically wrote the medical scenario almost in an if-then statement. So lots of branch chain logic that many of the programmers are very familiar with. And I personally have had an experience of programming back when I was little. If anyone remembers the language Pascal,
that was the language I learned.
Yes. Yay. Nerds unite. So I was able to think through medical cases in a way that a programmer would otherwise understand it. And then the artistry, the motion capture, and the graphics, the sounds and the voiceovers kind of came next that resembled what looked like cinematography. So you first start with the scenarios that you want, all the branch chain and logic. From an education background, we design the educational objectives to see which branches are really important, which branches are kind of important, but more like for realism and for aesthetics, and essentially craft the scenario from there and add the characters, the voiceovers, whatnot thereafter. So and that was pretty much the way we did it. It felt like creating a movie.
Yeah,
perhaps.
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
With the aspects of a choose your own adventure kind of thrown in, I would guess.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And what we know from VR, particularly for these types of training, is that this level of we wanted to capitalize on the level of immersion. And so, yes, there you need some agency, which is when you have some control or choose your own adventure. But we wanted to make sure that the educational objectives were being met from all the cool features of VR. And one of the educational objectives that Josh and I thought of very immediately was the idea of stress mitigation, that our ability to make clinical decisions changes when the environment is not conducive to optimal decision making, which can be high levels of stress, high levels of team stress, which is different than if you're totally fine, but if everyone else is panicking, then that completely changes things. And if your perceived stakes and values are also at line. So the example of that is for some practitioners, when they see a child in distress and they have, and that child is the same age as your own child, there are new thoughts that creep into your head about your own child that may or may not affect how you make decisions for that case, right? And we've seen this with other practitioners, and this is already outside of VR, but we wanted to safely induce small bits and pieces of that stress so that you could experience it, get inoculated to it, almost like a vaccine. And so the next time it happens, your ability to make clinical decision-making and manage cognitive load is a little bit better, and you'll be able to make better decisions. So that was the true educational overarching goal that we had in mind. And we felt that VR was the perfect medium, better than mannequins, better than a screen-based game in order to put you into that stressful scenario, but in a very regimented, controlled, safe, incremental way.
Wow.
And this, yeah, this kind of ties into my question. My next question is, because I, yeah, I, you mentioned these mannequins, and I kind of went down an internet rabbit hole this weekend looking at, you know, the companies that manufacture and sell these. And it's fascinating that they have these, you know, and I guess specific to your branch of medicine, they have basically little infant mannequins that you can actually use to perform, you know, you can practice CPR on them. You can practice lumbar puncture, spinal taps in a controlled fashion before you ever actually have to do that to a real child. And I can definitely see the advantage of that. And so is the idea with the VR that it would be a strict upgrade on this, or will it still be used alongside this? Are there trade-offs? You know, it's like, is the idea that eventually this stuff will be completely replaced by VR, or do they each have their roles? And what are the advantages of one and the other?
That's an excellent question. So a little story time. I think back in 2015 and 2016, when we first got started in the project, VR was amazing. And it was, to be quite honest, I thought it was going to take over the world and replace all other things and everything. Everyone just worships this idol of VR. It turns out that is not necessarily the case. And as we used VR more and more, it has very distinct advantages, and particularly in both healthcare and healthcare simulation, which are two slightly different fields, which we can go over a little bit later. But it has some disadvantages that the other modalities of training and simulation, like the mannequins that are startlingly real or realistic, or even patient actors. We use a lot of standardized patients who are actors a lot of the times to practice communication skills and human empathy, which VR is getting there, but it's right now the actors do a really nice job as well. So if you think of it, it's like a menu of options for which VR occupies a nice chunk because of its advantages, but there's plenty of other modalities that can help out, or you can hybridize them. So as an example, there are companies who are virtualizing CPR training. So I think everyone knows what CPR is like. There's someone, unfortunately, on the ground with full cardiac arrest. And we know that bystander CPR, which is myself, anyone walking down the street, at the school, at the mall, whatever building, if you're the first one to see this and you start CPR, that person has the highest chance of survival, better than if any physician reaches them in the emergency department, better than a paramedic reaching them. If you're right there, the earlier you start CPR, the higher the chance of survival. So we wanted to look at VR companies who can do these training scenarios, and there's quite a few in the world. And what's the VR will allow you to inhabit that stressful scenario. You can see a person fall down. You can see the panic faces around you, and it spurs you into action. But VR does not allow you to feel what the person feels like when they're on the ground, or feel how the ribs might recoil back at you when you push. Mm-hmm. And those are actually important feelings or haptics that you need. And that's where the mannequin gets inserted. So in that hybrid scenario, you use the VR to paint the visual and audio scenarios or the environment. And you use the mannequin to provide the tactile feedback. And we have specific CPR mannequins that have nice springs on the inside, so you get that very realistic recoil feel. So you can feel the actual exertion that's required as your VR provides the auditory and the visual scenarios. So you take VR as with its essentially the audio-visual advantages of VR, and play that into the different simulations that's required in healthcare. If you need haptics, then you add other modalities. If you need human emotion, you may need actual actors and things like that.
It's interesting. Yeah, that we've talked to other artists who do this too, or they do fixed installations that combine the visuals of VR with the haptics are not really there. That they can't simulate touch with VR alone, but they can have a space that you can actually walk around and physically touch objects while seeing things. So this is like, a more focused version of that. That's really interesting, though. Another thing you've done research on is the gamification of medical training. So, like, for example, I read one study you worked on in which healthcare professionals were given 24-hour day access to an infant mannequin that they could use to practice CPR like this, and that was able to give feedback data, performance scores that were then posted anonymously on a publicly visible leaderboard.
Yeah.
And so you turn this into a game where people get a little feedback, kind of like with your Fitbit, where, it tells me, you've walked the distance of the Russian steppes since you bought me. Congratulations. And no surprise that your study showed that, that compared to a control group who were not playing this game, these folks were encouraged to just keep their skills up, and they were more practiced after the study period ended. Is this something that's actually being used in hospital training programs already? And are there other aspects of healthcare that could be gamified in this way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So let's talk about gamification and healthcare. And we'll divide it to gamification and healthcare for patients, because that's what you're talking about with like the Fitbit, maybe like calorie counting, and which is slightly different than healthcare simulation and gamifying healthcare providers of whatever their task or
that was the one I was curious about, because I think the gamification of healthcare for patients, obviously that's something that we've already experiencing, but I was wondering how much this was being used in hospital settings. But yeah, feel free to talk about both.
So a little bit about that study. There are a couple of whole series of studies that we started when we first noted that there are certain CPR mannequins that will give you a score. And many different brands will do it. And it turned out back in the day, this was like in 2014 with some of my colleagues in Manchester, England, that as soon as you showed the score to your friend, and this is when social media was still like in that moderate okay stage where people were still posting cat pictures instead of meetings, they would share their score with each other. And then all of a sudden, their simulation center got a request for, can I just do this CPR out of nowhere? And so they're getting these self-motivated people who just wanted to practice CPR. Obviously, they're healthcare providers. They need to know how to do CPR. It's not like it's a pure game item. But this gamification behavior was seen in different places. And it goes beyond just CPR. I think folks in healthcare are reasonably competitive by nature. And so you'll see these little gamifications, points, badges, leaderboards as that minimum foundational level for gamification that you'll see out there. You'll see it in different trainings, maybe schools, continuing medical education credits. That's reasonably common here and there. What we decided to do and really explore is to see whether there's lasting effects. And this was right around the time when Ice Bucket Challenge was around. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was actually incredibly successful. In retrospect, we know why it was successful, but during the time, it made no sense of why it was successful, right? Here's some random person throwing ice on themselves and then screaming, and then all of a sudden, like, this organization gets money, which is amazing, right? What we noticed when we looked at the Ice Bucket Challenge is that you have these three-month peaks of interest, and then it gradually fades away, until you get a celebrity, for example, to do it. And then you get this nice three-month spike of interest. And you can see this with the Google word searches, where there's this huge interest for 3 months. And this three-month interval of motivation is really key to us. What we know from a lot of CPR studies, this was done in Philadelphia and other places, is that CPR is actually not easy. In the movies, it looks easy that you do a few compressions of the chest and all of a sudden they jump up and then they get to like go slay the dragon or whatever this plot line is. But in real life, actual CPR is incredibly taxing. And we know from our studies that unless you're physically fit, we tire out within 2 minutes and you really have to swap out with someone else. Even though the hero in us want to continue, we know from the data that after 2 minutes, you really, really, really should swap out, even if you don't realize it. And so what ended up happening with the study was that we saw a slight increase in the 3 months. You'll get these somebody doing CPR, you'll get the score, and then after it's posted, you'll get a little bit of interest, and then the interest will die down. So we found that motivation lasts about 3 months or less, and then it peters out. You have to have something else in order to re-trigger it. And it's the same amount of interval that the folks in Philadelphia and other places have found that our CPR skills start degrading.
Oh.
Yeah, so when you get your CPR certification, you know your stuff. You watch that video. You've pumped up. You know, you've pumped, yeah. You've pumped up. You got the card. And the day after you do your CPR training, you see the world differently. You're like walking around looking for people falling down so that you can run up to them, right? And so you have that nice adrenaline. You have that increased knowledge, and they do, in general, have better CPR skills. But after about 3 months of non-use, and let's face it, most of us will not get to use CPR for 3 months, your skills and your cognitive skills on it, your psychomotor skills, your strength skills and coordination start to peter out. And then by the end of 1 year, you're kind of just back to baseline. So what we've done now for training these skills that are rare is that every 3 months you need to top off. It's not like you go completely back to zero, but there is a likelihood that you have decay in your performance, that you need to top it off, just get a quick refresher, something nice to practice on. And we felt that because the three-month interval was seen in the Ice Bucket Challenge, that we could do a similar challenge to harness whatever this three-month phenomenon is of motivation and see if it works. So it works for the short term. It definitely does not work for the long term. And we actually found that the control group who did not post it but were able to talk about it locally were reasonably the same performance. Everyone was performing really well, which is also, whew, thank God, all these providers were having reasonable scores but when they did the CPR. So, yeah, it was very enlightening. We found nice short-term things, but we are still – exploring the way to do long-term motivation. And I don't think we've solved that yet for our field or anyone else's.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned that the doctors do tend to be competitive, but I was wondering, are there personality types that are resistant to attempts to gamify? I mean, if there are, I don't know that I've met many of them, but everyone seems to be able to be addicted in some way or another to this sort of feeling for competition. But I was just wondering if there are people who this doesn't do it.
Yeah. So Crystal Rutledge and I actually wrote an article about this. There actually is a hidden danger to doing gamification. There are certain personalities for whom the competition really works, and for their certain personalities, the competition is kind of a turnoff. And it's seen as this weird external justification for what really should be already intrinsically important. You know,
interesting.
If you really sit back and think about it, why would you need an external motivator of some selfie on a leaderboard to do a skill that literally is the most life-saving skill ever, right? Yeah. So we call this the discordance of the task value. Clearly there's a value of the task, but the perception of the task value is different than the actual task value of the thing itself. So if you think of traditional CPR training, you have to sign up for the class. It's a card. You take a day off for it. You know, you have to drive to this place. You have to kind of sit around. Like, it's a class that you sit for. And that's the perceived task value that does not match the actual life-saving aspect of it. And then for some of us, when you turn it into a game, the task value increases and we get motivated. For others, we don't like games, or we think games are for children, therefore, right? And therefore, the task value gets eliminated. There's a theory by Deci and all, D-E-C-I and all, that talks about the movement from a motivation, so not motivated at all, to extrinsic motivation, to intrinsic motivation. And we want people to be intrinsically motivated. That's when you genuinely feel and have that pure passion and motivation that we all seek to. But there are, but in the middle is external motivation. We either like the status of it, we like that we know we can do it, we can brag about it, or there's an external thing that I will make my patients proud for learning CPR or something like that. And all of those, in the end, you know how to do CPR, so we're not going to be picky about it.
Right.
But for some people, if they were on the road to be intrinsically motivated because they truly believe in CPR and they're passionate about it, but then you introduce this external game to it, it feels like it cheapens your intrinsic motivation. Okay. So for some people, it is a turnoff. We haven't really discovered, or I haven't discovered, I'm sure others have, of who you can predict the gamification will work on, who it would not. We do know that when somebody says, oh, I'm already competitive by nature, that by itself does not predict.
Yeah.
I think people just have pride in their competitiveness.
Yeah.
Well, American competitiveness.
Yeah, it was whenever you were talking about the 3 month interval of CPR training, I was thinking about the one time I was CPR certified, and I am like the people you talked about. The next day I woke up and I was like, oh crap, I hope someone doesn't collapse on me because I'm terrified. Because I'm actually going to have to do something. I'm one of those. I'm probably one of those people that would test on the loss of intrinsic value with gamifying. But thankfully, I'm not a doctor. That's the moral of the story here. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you got CPR certified, and we'll take this time to plug that everyone should be CPR certified.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
From business needs to social events, an increasing amount of connection is happening online in immersive virtual spaces. Navigating these unfamiliar platforms and technologies can seem daunting. Locusium is here to help. Locusium understands, guides, and informs your project so you can spend time connecting with your community and teams. Unlock more possibilities for connection through virtual events with Locusium. Visit locusium.com to learn more.
So you've kind of talked about some of the one aspect of my next question with the gamification and kind of the negative potentials for that. So I want to expand it, and with this question, you can answer it in any way you want. You can be specific or even be as broad as you want. So from your medical perspective, are there elements of virtual reality or its surrounding technology that concern you? And are there ethical fail-safes that you think need to be put in place in order to curb potential negatives?
Ooh.
And take your time, right? You don't have to.
Yeah.
This is a big question.
So, it is a big question, but I actually – I think I already know the answer to this. But in order to explain it, there's actually two answers because, as I've emphasized before – VR or simulation or whatever, VR for patients is different than VR for providers. So if you'll let me back up for just a few moments.
Oh, sure.
Just 30,000 foot view of what VR and eventually XR AR is for all healthcare. There's two primary uses for patients, two primary uses for providers. So in total, four. I know this is audio, so I'm trying to describe this chart that I have in my head. So of the two patient-focused VR uses currently, and they'll probably continue for quite some time, one is therapeutic distraction. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter what the VR shows as long as it's not what is happening in the real life. So we use this in healthcare for meditation. You take them out of their reality. It could be on the beach, relaxation. Or where I work, we do it for distraction therapy during painful procedures. So let's say you're getting a blood test and there's a needle on your arm and you don't like needles. You slap on VR goggles. You are somewhere else. And something's happening to your arm, but it's a little bit less painful. So that's called therapeutic distraction or therapeutic escape if you're totally transporting them out. And then the second way for patients is the opposite. You put them in a reality that is carefully and calculated, therapeutic desensitization. One of our USC professors, Skip Rizzo, has done a lot of work in VR, and PTSD treatments, particularly among the military or soldiers coming back from the field. And VR is used in that case to actually place them into a reality that you want that induces a certain level of stress or emotion, whatever that the target is, and you or the patient is able to calibrate it, so in a safe manner. And so his studies, the PTSD therapies, you use VR to almost recreate that trigger event, but you have full control of that event.
Okay.
In VR. So that's therapeutic desensitization. And in those two realms, when you asked me the question about where the bad sides of VR, it is possible that that therapeutic desensitization can be risky, right? Mm-hmm. You could absolutely trigger an emotion that was not intended. And so we have to be very mindful of that. We've seen those hilarious videos of people getting scared by horror VR, mm-hmm. and everyone around them laughs, and it's amusing on the outside. But there's are deeper horrors that you can actually have in that immersive VR that may have quite negative effects for the patients, whether it's intended or unintended,
mm-hmm.
right? And then on the flip side of the therapeutic escape, when you're trying to do distraction therapy, sometimes locking them into the VR and making them trying to force them away from the real world is also detrimental. And we've actually seen cases where we thought that the child who is experiencing a painful procedure somewhere else in their body would benefit from, you know, watching teddy bears in VR or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that occluding their senses away from the painful stimulus is actually worse, that not knowing what was happening to their body was way worse than experiencing it. Was in the VR was not actually helping. It was irrelevant. It was that they were taken away from the reality.
Like, why are you putting a blindfold on me when, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so it functioned as a blindfold rather than something they could actually attune to. And right now, we actually don't know who those people are. Sometimes the parents can tell us they would rather watch what's going on. Maybe you can ask the older kids or the adults, but they may not be perfect predictors of painful procedures, particularly if they don't know what it is. So that's the two patient sides. The two ways that providers use VR currently, and this applies to AR, XR, and all of those, is number one, three-dimensional anatomical modeling. So the human body is complex. Thinking 5 points for Todd Chang. Because of its complexity in that three-dimension complexity, particularly like the brain, the abdomen, or the heart, it is actually much easier to visualize and even quote-unquote walk through anatomical parts using VR, XR, whatever you have, because of the wonderful rendering ability it has. And I also put 360 video in there as well. I know that's kind of a slightly different type of three-degree of freedom passive VR, but you're allowed to basically witness a medical scenario, healthcare scenario, perhaps a disaster scenario if you need to with 360 VR. And that's how we would use 3D modeling for providers, training, desensitization, whatever it is. And then the fourth use of healthcare providers in VR is something that we've been using, which is simulation. You basically take the best cases of simulation and put them in a VR setting so that it feels real. Whatever that simulation may be, mm-hmm. It can be something benign like talking to a patient and learning how to do an interview process. Or it can be something more like catastrophic, such as how do you handle multiple resuscitations in a war zone? Right.
Wow. Okay.
And for those, for the two provider types, the bad sides of the bad sides of 3D modeling is accuracy. If the accuracy is just a little bit off and we learn something and we think is real and it turns out not to be real for whatever reason, then you can imagine the disastrous consequences. So mm-hmm. In 3D modeling, it has to be quite possibly the most accurate representation that you need, including if something's supposed to be moving, it should be moving. So it's no longer sufficient to just have a still heart. You need to have a beating heart in VR.
Wow.
Right, which you can do. It's not, you know, that's not impossible by any means. For simulation, the same caveats for simulation, it's the same, is that what you learn has to be truly applicable. If they learn something incorrectly because they push this button in a simulation and it happens to not be a real button in a real situation, they'll start looking for that button on the device, whatever.
Yeah.
Right. So there has to be a sense of fidelity to the real scenario. And the concept of fidelity is pretty intricate. People write PhD theses on fidelity and simulation. And in VR, it's also no joke. The level of reality doesn't have to be perfect. I don't think perfect fidelity is what we're looking for, but it has to be meaningful, purposeful fidelity, and really facilitated by somebody who knows what they're doing through either education or research, so they can work through all the thought patterns. As soon as you're done with the VR, you can process and debrief and things like that. And that's been written in our literature, the scientific literature, on how learning happens in simulation.
Awesome.
Whew, long-winded answer.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's just really interesting to sort of lay it out that way. And so have you, like, one of the things we've also discovered in other interviews is that whenever somebody brings something new to a field, obviously there are traditionalists who push back. And I'm wondering, has there been any resistance from people with more traditional attitudes towards medical training to the use of VR, or even to the, you know, the use of the mannequins?
And please name names. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm actually quite thankful for this podcast and the fact that people are listening to this, because healthcare simulation feels like a niche. It really shouldn't be. You should know that your physicians, nurses, and the people who are taking care of your family members who will take care of you are practicing not on humans, right? And we do it behind the scenes. We never tell you, oh, yeah, I did a CPR training class today. I think that would be really weird for a patient to know. But please know that we are constantly doing this. We crave this type of training.
Okay.
And we on the simulation and VR side are really crafting the most effective as best as we can to our knowledge and continually studying and improving it. So please know that all that is happening in the background. For all of us who are healthcare consumers or patients or family members. That being said, there's plenty of people who think all I do is play video games, which is actually true. So I have my VR headset in my office, and whenever my division chair walks past and sees me in VR, I won't know he's around, of course. And then I take my headset off, and he's been staring at me the whole time. He's supportive of my work and my research, but it always takes a while, right? There's never going to be a separation of the doctors doing VR for training versus the doctors playing Beat Saber.
Yeah.
Right. I find it humorous, but there's certainly people who don't quite put the two and two together, where they have either a negative or a innocent view of games and VR and have not yet seen the applications to the real world. And as long as we use the same principles that we use for simulation, where mannequin-based simulation, I think, has a reasonable amount of support and belief that it's commonplace. That's why those mannequin-based companies are thriving these days.
Mm-hmm.
I think VR is getting there, but right now we're in the lots of startups, and the small companies are getting together. And then probably in about 5 years, we'll start seeing some coalescence and some data to show that the best practices and worst practices of VR. So in healthcare simulation for mannequins, there are best and worst case practices that are written about and studied. In VR, we're barely starting. And you know, healthcare providers love data. We don't really want to act on whims or just opinions. We want to see some evidence that it works. So we are natural skeptics. And so when I'm trying to talk with other physicians who've never tried VR before and only know those videos of people getting scared with horror VR or falling down because of VR, that's what they think of VR. My job is to try and convince them, here's the data that I'm working on. Here's what it's good for. Here's what it's not good for. Here's what I think are best use cases. Here's what I think are not best use cases. And this is how I intend to deploy it. And so that's my life's calling, is that I'm trying to convince VR that it's not going to be the end-all be-all of training. Sorry for those of you who are investing in VR yeah. stuff, but it is an incredibly important part of healthcare training, simulation, and healthcare in general. And we should be neutral, be open-minded to find out the best practices of VR and the worst practices so that we know where not to go and we know where it should be going. And I think that's where we will start convincing the people who are natural skeptics of the new technologies used in this area.
Yeah, I would. That's my. I'm kind of the VR skeptic on the podcast, and so a lot of my questions tend to be like, what are the negatives of this thing? So, but I find it sounds like, at least on the you know, the medical simulation side of things, that they're, at least from your perspective, and I would imagine it's probably across board on anyone who's working on this, is that there are built in, because of the nature of the profession and the nature of the people who work in that profession, there's a kind of built in ethics kind of already there, because you're dealing with actual people ultimately, and you don't want to train in a way that is going to be disastrous for those procedures. So that's just recognizing that is beneficial in my mind to know that there's people that understand the caution around new technology. And I would imagine some of the pushback is probably around this kind of, not necessarily antiquated, but this idea of, well, it's reality versus, you know, fake. So, which is, that's a very simplistic understanding of the difference between actual quote unquote metaphysical reality and virtual reality. And so I would imagine some of those people can't quite cross that chasm. Have you noticed that kind of mindset?
Let me see if I got your question correctly. Yeah. I'm digging this idea of metaphysical.
But just like I've got a computer in front of me. I can feel the keyboard, like the just reality as most people understand it versus virtual reality.
Oh, so. Yeah, we deal with that all the time. And what's funny about I think you guys have probably covered the Uncanny Valley. Mm-hmm. There's a similar concept where when we do healthcare simulation, whether it's VR, screen-based game, or mannequins, or even actors, there's an incomplete understanding of fidelity and reality, that we want to approach reality as much as possible, but we also know that it just isn't. Like, mm-hmm. we want it to not actually be real patients for a reason, because we don't want to practice on real patients.
Yeah.
So there's a fundamental understanding that we, as close as we are going to get to reality, it cannot be reality.
Yeah.
We can't practice on real patients like that. So what's been worked on instead is that the people who are unable to cross the chasm expect full-on reality, and then they'll critique the experience by saying, oh, you know, these controllers, I wouldn't normally use controllers, so I kind of was never into the scenario, or I was talking to this character and they didn't really respond very, you know, they responded like my Siri responded, so I didn't really get into the scenario. So it's not quite the uncanny valley phenomenon, but they can't get into the scenario because they expected full reality and are disappointed by the lack of full reality.
That makes sense.
And so what we've done in simulation of VR as well is to really emphasize that there are elements that are real or feel real, and any emotions, feelings of reality are genuine, and we want you to honor that. However, here are the parts that are not real. And we ask you, between you and me, this fiction contract, to really work with it, really get yourself into the scenario, because once you're in the scenario and you lose yourself in the scenario, it will the learning objectives will be met and you'll actually learn something or feel something.
Okay.
Whatever.
Fascinating.
All right. Yeah. So I think it is not sufficient to ignore the chasm or try and move everyone towards reality. It is far more important to recognize what is not real and honor it and use it to our advantage. So can I give you a concrete example?
Yeah, go for it.
When we first set out in 2016, before I really realized this epiphany, we wanted to make this VR as real as possible. That was like, it's the selling tag. And this Oculus loved it. AISoft loved it. BioFlight loved it. We loved it. The idea that we were going to create full-on immersive reality. Woo! And we had a research hypothesis, and that was that we could measure people's heart rates and salivary cortisol levels, the stress hormone, during a real resuscitation, because we have them in our hospital and we have research coordinators that can actually, it was fun. They stuck cotton swabs in our mouths when we were working to collect salivary cortisol levels after the event, of course. And we basically did the same thing. We invited the same people back to the virtual reality when it was done. And we were betting, we hypothesized that our stress physiologies, our heart rates, and our cortisol levels would be identical to the real deal. And we were really banking on this and actually proposed this as a true hypothesis, that it would be the same. Alas, our paper showed and our data shows that it is not the same. The VR has less stress hormones for us and less heart rate increases than the real deal. And when we compared it to other VR studies in the primitive VR ages, like in the early 2000s, there were reports on heart rate monitoring and virtual first date or virtual job interview. And their heart rates ranged from between 4 to 7 increase from baseline beats per minute. Not a lot, but very consistent. Mm-hmm. We actually found in VR about, well, I think it was 6.8 beats per minute consistently above baseline when you're in VR. But in real life, you were at least 13 or higher.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
And in real life, we definitely had long-standing cortisol changes after one resuscitation. And in VR, we saw zero changes in cortisol after an hour of VR.
Interesting.
Because on some level, you know it's not real.
Yeah, yeah. We invited them to an office. They were in my office, literally, in a VR headset on their day off, wearing normal casual clothes. You know, so from a hypothesis point of view, because I was a scientist, I really wanted to prove this and I wanted to be neutral, I was disappointed, right? Like, mm-hmm. we were disappointed that this scientist claimed that it was going to be the same, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
And then when we really looked back at it, number one, you're right. It just isn't the same. Like, you're not in the same place. The context is wildly different when you enter VR, at least, because you're on your day off. They're in jeans. And they know that I'm inviting them into virtual reality. Mm-hmm. And we also realized when we proposed it as an educational simulation training, what if we don't want all that stress? You know, like, there is a negative consequence to revving them up to really high heart rate levels and things like that. When Hollywood did their studies on horror movies and heart rates, quote unquote best scare moments of horror movies raised your heart rate up by almost 40.
Wow. Okay.
Right. And it's not necessarily a metric of like success for the movie, but that's what they found in that study. So when someone asked me, well, why didn't you design your VR to have a heart rate of 40? I actually paused and said, you know, like, I don't think that's actually a good idea. A horror movie is designed to mesmerize and to give you that adrenaline rush so that you talk about it at the end, right? And it feels interesting to you. Not necessarily good, but interesting to you. I don't think we want a horror movie in a VR for training. We don't want you to come out of there just terrified of the mm-hmm. event and talking about it. We want you to come away inoculated so that you can manage that level of stress. And so we actually opted, and there's this thing called the Yerkes-Dodson curve, Yerkes-Dodson curve, where it's this bell curve. On the left-hand side is zero stimulation. On the right-hand side is total overwhelming stimulation, whether it's stress or whatnot. And then on the y-axis vertically is your performance, your quality of performance. This also does attention span as well. So when you have absolutely no stimulation, when you're bored out of your mind, you're just not going to perform very well on the very left. On the very right, when you are totally overstimulated, fearful, way too euphoric, or in any polar emotion state, you're just not going to perform well either. And then somewhere in the middle, you have enough stimulation. Things are happening. The game is interesting. The movie is interesting. The patient and the team is working, that you actually perform optimally. And so what we decided was that the real life scenario is maybe a little too far on the right, particularly for novice physicians and nurses. And so having something, a VR scenario that is stressful because it does increase your heart rate to six more than baseline. The fact that it does it less than real life is actually an advantage.
Okay.
Right. And so we then repackaged it. This is where we're talking about best practices. We repackaged it as a scenario designed for novices who are entering our field of emergency medicine.
That makes sense.
So that's where we are at the moment, where our first-year interns are have this as their curriculum. Their third-year graduates are unlikely to benefit. They like it. It's fun. But the best value for the buck, so to speak, is the novices. And Columbia University and my colleague Dave Kessler and others have actually done a study measuring cognitive load and stress levels. If you do the same scenario with an experienced person and an inexperienced person, the inexperienced person, even if they perform just as well, so they get all the medications right, the patient lives and everyone collapses, their stress level, their stress hormone, cortisol level, and their cognitive load is almost twice as high as the experts. Even though they're, when you look at the performance data, it looks identical.
Wow.
So
and would you say that that same kind of difference in cortisol and heart rates would kind of track onto real life scenarios where the intern in that space would be at a higher cortisol, higher heartbeat than someone who has been in those spaces longer? Or is it negligible? Or does that make sense?
Yeah. I would love to know as well. There have been other studies done on other – I think there was a Spanish study in Spain. I forget what country it was from, where they actually measured physiologies among trainees performing emergency procedures. And their stress responses were like out of control, way more than what we had reported in our study.
Mm-hmm.
I think heart rates were definitely increasing by double digits, more so than 13.
Wow.
And so the likelihood is yes. And then what happens is then those novices in that real situation will then be all the way on the right of the Yerkes-Dodson curve, right? That bell curve of performance. And their performance is likely to be poor or at least affected.
Gotcha.
And so what we think is happening is that the expert, even if they perform the same, will experience less stress. So they experience less cognitive load, hopefully. They can process things in their mind better so that if something unexpected or off script happens, which happens regularly, then they can react appropriately. We know that if a patient like behaves in exactly a very stereotyped illness manner, like this heart rate goes like this when I give the medicine, then it doesn't, for an experienced person, it doesn't, you know, or even a novice, it's not that hard to manage the patient.
But
when they go off script, which is where all the stories and, you know, House and ER and all those cool shows talk about, that's when the physician and nurse and all the healthcare professionals really need to react. And that level of reaction and moving around the different scripts and being nimble is really it takes a lot of mental power. And that mental power is completely depleted if you are overstressed in those scenarios.
Oh, fascinating. So the rest of the questions should be a little bit lighter in tone. We got past the hard ones, so you passed the hardest part.
Yay!
So from your perspective now, looking into the future, what other developments within the intersections of VR and medicine would you like to see or be part of developing?
Sure. That's a really good question, trying to predict the future. And spoiler alert, I would love to work with as many VR developers and game developers as possible. That's kind of my thing. So just please let me know.
Okay.
If any are listening.
So my personal interest in healthcare simulation that's my number one passion. That I believe that simulation and recreating certain events very carefully, not necessarily for full reality, but a very scripted, curated reality is beneficial for training. So we call it experiential learning. I think VR's haptic capabilities will improve. Mm-hmm. So currently, the things that require good haptics, like there are certain nurses who I've trained with and who I would trust my life and probably are good enough to be decent physicians just because of their experience. They can put an IV in like a less than 1 kilo NICU premature baby with their eyes closed. Like they're that good.
Wow.
But they do it from this feel and the give with doing the finger and this like imperceptible nuances of their fingertips that I don't think you can do in VR currently, even with the best controllers, even with Leap Motion and stuff that you can project your hands on. And so right now we're exploring hybrid simulation where the physical objects are actually in front of you and kind of almost getting to the XR AR world. Which I think is the near future is that once AR gets to where VR is currently, you can see a lot more of that in healthcare in slightly different ways, but still with 3D modeling and simulations. So I think that's where the future will go, where the haptics will become much more integrated. And then number two, now that 5G is out and better connectivity, much more multiplayer because healthcare is a team sport, right? It's not really a sport, but you know, it's a team activity.
Yeah.
Quite a few people, both synchronously, asynchronously, and sometimes if the disease pattern or the disease condition requires a lot of specialists, they may not all be in the same place. And part of that teamwork training is actually really difficult. So right now, VR is mostly focused on the one-on-one training or one-on-AI training. There are multiplayer versions out there, but it takes a lot of bandwidth. And if you imagine, just like in the movies, when you have a critical CPR going on, there's a ton of people in the room, you know, COVID notwithstanding. And it's really hard to train those. And then, so the ultimate holy grail, I think, particularly in healthcare simulation, where VR, I think, will have the best head start, is mass casualty simulation. We know it's a thing, whether it's man-made or natural, and it's incredibly difficult to train for. Right now, we would say rent a warehouse or a parking lot, get a whole bunch of volunteers to play victims, and for pediatric mass casualty, I think at one point we asked the local Boy Scout troops to volunteer and got a whole bunch of people to get red paint and little scars all over. They really like that part. So it's fun. It's effective, but there's still a little, you know, it doesn't, you're doing it at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning and yeah, the birds are chirping and everyone's, you know, having donuts on the other side. So it doesn't feel like a true mass casualty. You don't get that sense. And logistically, it just is a bit of a nightmare. So what if VR could simulate the entirety of all the casualties, like right then and there, switch them around, change them around, whatever you need, and create the environmental scenario, whether it's, you know, fire in the background, sirens, vocalizations, bombs.
Wow.
And at that point, you don't have to have everybody in the same physical space too, which is the other advantage, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is really good right now.
Oh man, no kidding.
As we have been discovering, yeah. Yeah.
So let's speak more practically for you. What's on the horizon? Do you have any projects you're working on or developing in the coming days?
Yeah. So I'm still working with our colleagues at AI Solve, who were our initial partners in 2016. They have some really good stuff. They're not paying me, so just so everyone knows. But we still work with them to try and get out more and more scenarios so that we can get a little library of simulations. And there's a couple of other companies that have contacted me. There's a company, Tetra Signum, that does VR CPR, and we're joining a randomized control trial that their university in Korea is hosting. So a nice international VR trial. And I really want to explore these best practices and really get the data. We can get small in-hospital data, but at some point you have to test it on a lot of physicians or nurses and really measure whether their patient care gets better in the future. And that's a tough endeavor, number one, just logistically. And how do you know it was the VR and not something else? Because mm-hmm. it's not like without VR, they're just the doctors are sitting in a closet not doing anything.
I would imagine that would be I would imagine that'd be really hard to quantify just on a statistical level.
Yeah. So there's really talented people who work with me on how to do that, but that requires a lot of planning, some research infrastructure that we're trying to build. And then finally, a slight departure, but perhaps an inspiration for another podcast with other people, is the concept of VR embodiment. I don't know. Have you covered this in other podcasts? Because it happens in healthcare.
We've happened upon it. We haven't actually dug into that concept specifically.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of work from Mel Slater, literally spelled as it sounds. He's an UK expat in Barcelona who has an embodiment lab. And he's done a fair amount of work with both psychology and healthcare. So from the healthcare world, we can talk about like diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's a big deal for healthcare because it affects the type of care and the outcomes that different populations experience depending on the group that they belong to, for example. So we make an effort in healthcare to try and reduce the inequities of healthcare outcomes and healthcare access. And one of the ways that we're trying to do that is embodiment through VR. And I'm trying to find a way to really incorporate this into simulation-based training. So we know that with embodiment, Mel Slater's work is that you can actually swap out yourself with an avatar of your choosing. So that you inhabit a character, and in VR, you're looking at mirrors, you're walking around, and every time you look down at your hands, you see a different set of hands that may or may not be yours, maybe different in age, skin color, gender, identity, whatever it may be. And you, every time you look in the mirror, you mirror back this other person. And Mel's worker has actually shown that inhabiting these other personas decreases implicit bias and negative feelings towards that particular represented group.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, no doubt.
And it is also likely that you don't necessarily have to make it like in your face explicitly, like, this is an Asian person. Rah, you're going to learn about Asian people. Like, I don't think that's the tone that it needs to be in. Because with VR, switching skins is actually not that hard. Right. Both from a cost standpoint and from a programming standpoint, it's just art and just a couple of polygons. So theoretically, it is actually really easy to swap out the demographic of any characters that you inhabit, either yourself as the player or the NPCs around you that interact with you. And just having that level of curated and thoughtful use of I suppose the interactions without it having to be the most explicit thing as a true learning objective while you're learning CPR or other things could actually go a long way. It basically normalizes the idea that DEI can be something that you just inherently have in VR characters, in healthcare access and healthcare simulations. And I really am looking for ways to just incorporate that just in the side with all of the work that we do from now on with VR.
Wow.
It shouldn't be that hard, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, from a programming standpoint, it's not that difficult.
The tricky part is going to be probably figuring out, is it working the way you want? Again, the best practices and what is the actual effect, but that's a really interesting use of it.
All right. It goes along the same principles of the stress inoculation. You're just inoculated to the environment so that, oh yeah, you know, there that person is. There's that trans person.
Yeah.
You know, let's find out about her, you know, health issues and whatever. So it feels like an opportunity to normalize because they're just there and your learning objective is about CPR or whatever the random topic might be.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So I had one final purely self-indulgent question. So what games do you play for fun?
Oh, very good question.
When you're not on the clock. Yeah.
Yeah. in the course of learning about VR, because I started with very little technical knowledge, I had to learn a lot about computers. And so I'm proud to say that I built my first computer, a PC, a couple months ago, after watching so many hours of YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
And and I made it VR ready, of course. So it has a pretty decent graphics card. This was before the 3080s and 3070s. So it was, I think it's a 2070 Ti NVIDIA, for those of you nerdies out there. Currently, I've always been enamored with role-playing games because they tell a nice narrative. And so the Final Fantasy series have been my favorite. I currently play Final Fantasy 14 on occasion, maybe once a week or so. I do like Beat Saber. I'm not very good at it. And
I'm not either. Yeah. No.
Yeah. And then Sid Meier's Civilization VI. I like those resource management games. I used to play StarCraft 2, and then my wrist got really bad because I have to type a lot at work too, so I decided not to play that anymore. But I'm constantly fascinated by resource management games. They kind of reflect how an emergency department's run, so mm-hmm. It gives that nice adrenaline rush, I suppose.
Yeah, I was about to say that sounds like it would be at least on some level beneficial, just on a strategic practice.
Yeah. You have no idea how us ED doctors do. Like, in my last shift, I would plan out, I'm walking to room 7 to see this person. On the way, I see room 8 and 10. I'm going to stop in and look in there. That'll take 5 seconds. Unless they have a question, in which case I have to then reverse my order. Like all these plans, is, in addition to all the medicine that we have to do. As
oh,
well.
My gosh.
So, yeah, and it's all about like value, time value and efficiency. And all my EM colleagues know exactly what I'm talking about. It's a constant fascination in our heads.
Wow. Well, yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. This has been really interesting. So, and yeah, good luck with this stuff. This is really interesting stuff.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And thank you for allowing me to talk about what I'm really passionate about. And,
yeah.
We in the healthcare world are working really hard for you guys in very innovative ways. And yeah, be nice to us. We're busy.
Oh, no doubt.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.
That is it for this episode of 88 Names Podcast. If you like the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and a review, which will help us get more listeners. Remember to check back at the podcast site at riseupdaily.com/88namespodcast for the podcast introduction and upcoming written interviews and articles.